Thank you, Stephen. And again, good morning. It's great to see so many of you here. I know a lot of you just got out of being stuck in traffic from last night, so I'm glad you made it. It's good to be together as we begin Holy Week 2019. How many of you have watched a little basketball lately? Anybody recently? Yeah. March Madness featured some fantastic games and finals. I can't remember a season where there have been so many close games. For instance, the clash between the Baptists and the Catholics was really exciting last Sunday. Since we used to live in Waco, I was cheering for Baylor, where there are more Baptists than people. And they won. They won. It was very, very exciting. And then Monday's men's final was incredibly close again. You know, somehow the Cavaliers pulled out another victory. It was a great story. Since last year, they lost for the first time in history to the 16 seed. So what a turnaround there. So, or if you're not a sports fan, how many of you watched the Academy Awards? This is another version of March Madness, I think. In another category, but we see fans who are reveling in the stargazing and the gawking and the glitter and the glamour, and interviewers are popping questions about Oscar picks and designers, and an estimated 1 billion people on the planet watch the award show. It's about one in every 7 or 8 people. That's a lot of people. Luke 19 describes another red carpet event. There are not a billion people in Jerusalem, but the place is booming on that first Palm Sunday. A major event, the Passover festival, is underway, and into the midst of the masses comes Jesus. And he receives a red, or perhaps we should call it a green, carpet kind of welcome. Luke tells us that the folks ran ahead and spread their cloaks on the road as he came in. But I find it interesting in Luke that he tells a palm-free story. Did you notice that? When Stephen read, no mention of palms, just a mention of cloaks. So maybe this should be Cloak Sunday instead of palms. Anyway, Luke does tell us that the people praised God joyfully with loud voices for all the deeds of power they had witnessed from Jesus up to that point. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven. But many of those in the multitude, and many of us perhaps, still miss the subtleties and the sub-themes within Luke's account. Luke makes some interesting adjustments to his story, which is filled with images that evoke meaningful faith traditions and also secular rituals from the Roman Empire. For instance, commandeering an animal for personal use was a prerogative of the Roman rulers, but also for kings of Israel. And riding a donkey zips us back to the story from Zechariah 9. And I'd like to give a little more thought to that donkey. Jesus is entering on a donkey usually is misunderstood as an act of extreme humility based on the text in Zechariah 9:9. To our eyes, you know, that donkey is a humble, docile animal. But to the Israelites, it was the animal of choice for hill country chieftains like David. It was kind of the SUV or the ATV of the day, if you will, the off-road vehicle of the time. Horses, of course, tended to be vulnerable on rocky, uneven ground, and so the royal animal of the Israelite kings was a donkey who could be relied upon not to break a leg on the way to its destination. Then you have the disciples shouting out their welcome, which harkens back to the welcome images in Psalm 118, the stones crying out. It's a reference to Habakkuk chapter 2, and then Jesus' entry into the capital city would also call the other Roman triumphs, these leaders coming in with their military troops surrounding them. But unlike those kinds of folk, Jesus wears no crown. Jesus rides into Jerusalem in a way that is an unmistakable claim to be Messiah, God's anointed one. This is an act of glorious defiance, really. It's an act of superlative courage and remarkable resistance. And there's another parade probably going on in Jerusalem at the time. I invite you to check out Marcus Borg's book, The Last Week. Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, is also probably arriving into Jerusalem at the head of a column of imperial cavalry and soldiers. His parade displays imperial power and theology. He embodies a rival social order, but also a rival theology. And so guess what? There's a clash coming. There is a clash coming between Rome and the realm of God, and it will not be pretty. In the next few verses, if you look at verse 41 in that chapter, Luke describes Jesus not as one who's celebrating, but as one who is full of sorrow. Now, this is a day that should be, you know, a day filled with big smiles and high fives and awards and acceptance speeches and cutting down the nets. It should be one of those kinds of days. It's not a day for crying. But that's what Jesus does. And the word used for weeping in verse 41 is not heavy enough. The translation probably describes the kind of heartbreaking sobbing that we often associate with difficult deaths and funerals and great loss. Heartbreaking sobbing. I think we, as the people of God, know about crying, and we know about crying out. I wonder, have you ever been happy and sad at the same time? Have you ever bawled at the birth of a baby? Have you ever wept at a wedding? Have you ever been amused during a memorial service? When something really painful has happened in your life, have you said something like this, "I have to laugh to keep from crying"? During Lent, we've considered the theme opportunity. We thought about tempting, fruitful, and extravagant opportunities, as well as opportunities to come home when we lose our way. And today is Palm Sunday, which we also call Passion Sunday. And this story from Luke reminds us that there are times to cry out in joy, but there are also some times to cry out in despair. And so this morning I invite you to consider this question: what will we do with this story? And what will this story do to us? Will it cause us to cry or cry out or both? Will we as disciples of Jesus make courageous decisions? Can we stand up for God when the more comfortable thing and safe thing would be to sit down, be silent, and not act or speak up? When Jesus enters Jerusalem, he enters as a prophet. And he knows that the real troublemakers in the crowd are not the ignorant and the cruel. The real troublemakers, as is often the case, are the intelligent and the corrupt. So, one author urges us just to remember the demands of discipleship. What does it mean to follow Jesus? He says there's a way of life, if adopted, would address the social and political problems from which we suffer. He points out that the word disciple is used over 250 times in the New Testament. The term Christian is rare. He says the New Testament is full of books and letters about disciples, by disciples, and for disciples of Jesus Christ. But he wonders, have we lost sight of that? He says for at least several decades, churches have not made discipleship a condition for being a Christian. And he says American churches in particular do not require following Jesus in example, spirit, and teachings as a condition for membership. No one yet knows what changes would be wrought if the ways and teachings of Jesus were truly tried in human affairs. Now those are mighty strong words. Yikes. Do you agree? Disagree? And are we passing those expectations on to our children? Are we passing these stories of discipleship on to the next generation? You probably are well aware of some of the trends in our own country. Studies indicate that 65% of the greatest generation felt like they had a fairly good handle on what it means to be a follower of Jesus. The number drops to about half, 35% for the boomers, folks in my group. So will it continue to slide with each generation? You know, that's alarming statistics. But just like on Palm Sunday, we have to pick our parade, it seems. We've got to pick our parade. Will we choose imperial power, or will we choose the realm of God? You know, Pilate is long gone, but there are plenty of others who have taken his place, right? They are vying for our time, they're vying for our attention, they're vying for our loyalty, our resources, our money. And some are pretty seductive, and they present themselves in all kinds of ways, even as entertainment. For instance, around $10 billion was bet on basketball games, and that's a conservative figure, I think. Another billion oohed and aahed about the Oscars. Apparently, almost another billion can't wait for the premiere of season 8 of Game of Thrones, TV's most popular show that will be shown in 186 countries around the world. And surely we can't miss the irony. Surely we can't miss the irony in our own city of having a thunderous celebration of military might as Holy Week begins. It's interesting. Or consider the growing numbers of other parades and marches. There are protests about what matters and what doesn't. There are clashes between supremacists and anti-racists. There are battles between bridge builders and wall builders. So what kinds of values are being offered in all of these things? And where are we likely to find Jesus on that donkey? And do we know enough about him to pick the right parade? I read about some college students who went to Haiti recently. They traded spring break days for mission trip days, and when they arrived, they were really excited for a while. They were soon shocked by the hostility they received from the various groups that controlled the neighborhoods. The students were not welcomed, and yet they did not give up. They stayed focused on their work and their mission. They tried to make friends, especially with the little ones. By the end of the week, things changed a bit. People warmed up to their presence, befriended them, and eventually were grateful for their work. Their discipleship story is encouraging and becoming more common. Our young people, our children, are growing up with volunteering as part of their lifestyle, as hands-on mission opportunities become important to them. And it doesn't always turn out that way, of course. But there is great power and potential when we follow. We have to choose to take this risk of moving ahead. We have to become vulnerable for Christ's sake. And so what kind of opportunities do we as disciples look for? You know, most of them are not all that dramatic. Some of them will be simply a matter of trying to live out the great commandment to love God and to love neighbor. Others will involve just trying to take the high but even more rocky and demanding role and road of discipleship. Most of these opportunities will not be a matter of life or death. Or maybe they will.